Welcome to 0 to 1, the podcast for aspiring entrepreneurs who want to start but don't know where to begin. We are Jonathan and Gary, founders of Colleague, a company bringing AI into businesses, and Matteo, a Columbia student passionate about entrepreneurship. Here, we break down strategies, mistakes, and successes to help turn your ideas into action.
Hi everyone, in this latest episode of 0 to 1, we have the honor of hosting Arjun Mahadevan, co-founder and CEO of Doula, the one-stop shop for US and non-US founders to form and run the US business from anywhere, fast, and in just a few clicks. In less than 5 years, Doula scaled to $1 million in ARR and is helping thousands of companies open their offices in the US by taking care of all the admin and regulatory work. Welcome to 0 to 1, Arjun. Thank you for coming here, and how's it going?
Thank you for having me on. Very excited to be here and to share more about Doula's story.
Great. Before we hop on, just like, can you maybe introduce yourself for our audience to know who's Arjun and what you do with Doula? What's your mission, your core mission?
Our mission is to reach 1 billion founders and help them start their dream e-commerce business, but then scale it. Because I've never met an entrepreneur who just wants to start and then get one sale. They want to go for many more sales, whether it's 5, 6, 7, 8 figures or beyond. And the way we do that is through our business in a box for e-commerce. Many founders, they first go to Google. They have to find 5 different solutions for how to start a business or do taxes or bookkeeping, and it gives them a migraine. It's all counterintuitive. It's opposite advice that conflicts. So our goal is, how can we put the information in one place and the tools in one place so that founders don't feel like they have to start a company and then get a checklist of things to do where they've been thrown to the wolves? So the business in a box includes formation in all 50 states. We can even help you get a sales tax registration. We'll do your business bookkeeping with human bookkeepers, business taxes with the IRS, and then our newest offering, which is e-commerce analytics. So you can actually understand how your business is running. The saying goes, you can only manage what you can measure. And ultimately, your goal is then your entire back office, instead of having 5 tools for 5 prices and 5 points of contact, you have one point of contact, that's Doula, who's with you every step of the way.
Very clear. Thank you, Arjun. So before diving deeper into Doula, can you maybe tell us what made you want to become an entrepreneur?
The very first entrepreneurial thing I did that I can remember is in high school. I grew up in Boston and it snows a lot there in the winter. So when it snowed, at first the rule was we had to help shovel our driveway. And I don't think our parents paid us for that. We just had to go do that. Like, it's your driveway, your house, you have to go shovel the driveway. But then the neighbors, if you shoveled their driveway, they would pay you a little bit. So I was like, okay, that's cool. I can go shovel snow and they'll pay me a little. So we started doing that every time it would snow. We'd look forward to it, like wake up early, shovel our driveway, then quickly go to the neighbors and ask them, hey, can I come here after and shovel your driveway? Maybe you make a couple $100. Then I learned about leverage. I know what the term leverage is now, but the first piece of leverage we got was my dad bought an electric snowblower. So we could now do our driveway. It was this machine, it was heated. It could do it in a fraction of the time. And then I was like, wait a second, why don't I take the electric snowblower and go do neighbors' houses so I can do them even faster? I was also lucky because I had free inventory. I wasn't paying for it. My dad was. He wasn't charging me on it. So I learned this concept called leverage. Then again, I wasn't thinking about this back then. So that was the very first thing. But I'd be lying if I said at that moment is when I dreamed about helping e-commerce businesses start and scale LLCs. That'd be BS. The truth is, I didn't know what an LLC was before starting Doula. And I think another thing I've learned is that generalist start companies, especially the scale companies, yes, there's edge cases, but I think part of the beauty with Doula is we had a team. I didn't know what entity formation or bookkeeping or taxes really were, but it allows you to look at a problem and ask, why does it have to be this way? And the be this way for us is it didn't make sense to have all these tools in different places when people just want it in one place. That's what I wanted. And turns out, over 10,000 people globally from over 175 countries want this too. That's how many people we've served over the last four plus years. And the truth is that once you get the itch, it's hard to unscratch it. So you can look at Doula today, but before Doula, okay, technically let's call that snow shoveling business a business. When I was in San Francisco, after I left my job at Dropbox, I tried 3 different things, which all didn't work. None of them worked. And in hindsight, it's very clear how they all connected to Doula. But another thing I've learned is that beneath the tip of the iceberg, for whatever you want to call something that's working, beneath the iceberg is a ton of things that didn't work. So I'm also very cognizant of that. And I think that most people who've quote unquote made progress in anything in life, they've failed more times than most people have tried. And that's why they're actually in that position. So with Doula, all the things from the past led to where we are today. And now our goal is, hey, we have something that's working for these founders. How can we help unlock that entrepreneurial itch in millions, if not billions of people globally? And then again, help them scale that business too and take care of their back office for them.
Mm-hmm. Very, very clear. And what was the very first step you took to validate the idea when creating Doula? I know you also like work as a product manager for a couple of years. How did you like use your product manager hat to figure out your product market fit and make sure that it was the right thing to build at that time?
The first 100 customers, it's not pretty. It's really ugly, actually. What we did is in network, there was a company that was actually interested in applying to YC and needed a C Corp. So we got kind of lucky, but hey, like use your network. You have to do whatever it takes for the first customers. And then I went through Twitter and I started DMing people. Hey, do you know anyone looking to start a company? Very spray and pray, but it's not pretty. We also started our first paid ad for Start LLC for non-US resident. That was the initial wedge or Trojan horse. Then from there, the very first customer, they were looking to come to the US. And what they said was they wanted a bit more of a white glove approach versus some existing offerings, but they also wanted something maybe a bit more automated or tech friendly, bundled as well. So that was the first customer. And then I believe if you can get one customer, can you get two? If you can get two, can you get three? If you can get three, can you get five? If you can get five, can you get eight? You can always just keep adding more. And that's what we did with the first initial outbound from Twitter, paid ads when leads would hit our website. You treat them like they're the last lead on earth. You know, I'd be on my phone with them, messaging them. As long as I'm awake, I'd be messaging them. And with time, you actually can get, okay, cool, there's a pain point. You start to hear patterns, let alone across 5 or 10 customers versus 100. So that is how actually we just validated, okay, there's clearly people out here who need this. And we knew that there weren't really great solutions helping international founders specifically. They either required you to have a social or they wouldn't work with you if you didn't have a social whatsoever. And ultimately, we took that a bit personally. Like, that's BS. There's founders all over the world who are legitimate entrepreneurs. What do you mean just because you don't have a social, you can't start a business or work in the US too? So there was a bit of, not going to lie, pride around, hey, let's prove these people wrong and help these international founders. To answer the last part of your question, though, being a Dropbox PM didn't really help me. And I'll tell you why. When I was at Dropbox, we had these processes for like writing a P0, a P1, a P2, a P3, a P4, which was a 4-step or 5-step process for a product review. And it made sense at Dropbox's stage or scale because you have so many moving pieces, you need all that planning to make these decisions. When you're a startup with no customers, you don't need a planning doc. You hop on a call and say, what are we trying? Go do the thing and see if it works. So I had to unlearn that habit. Although now that we are reaching a bit more scale, again, there's way more room to go. I think that planning is important. I just think that, again, when you have nothing, there's no point to do a 5-week P0 process. Like literally just take 5 minutes to think of something, do some thinking, and then go out and build the thing too. So it was a bit of a lesson to unlearn where I actually thought I had to be a PM or like work at a tech company to learn how to start a company. Not true. I think founding a company and scaling a company is very different. And I think more so the things I learned at Dropbox helped during the scale-up portion versus the startup portion.
So in hindsight, from what I understand, being a PM at Dropbox really didn't help you because you had to unlearn certain concepts. So if you could like go back in time, do you think aiming to work for those big tech companies might be the right answer if you want to launch your startup? Or should you start, for example, working at a small startup and learning from scratch from there?
I can't say, and to clarify, I can't say it didn't help because here I am today. And I ultimately believe that there's a Latin saying, amor fati or amor fati, that everything happened for a reason up until where you are. Not to get wooey, but actually the things that happened got to where you are today. So at Dropbox, those sequence of events led to where we are now. What I will say though, is I thought that I had to do it to learn how to start a company. I don't think that's the case. The way you learn how to start a company is you go out there and start a company. I didn't really need that knowledge or experience. Now, let me share some truths. Having Dropbox on my resume, that helps, right? The same way having Y Combinator on your resume helps. People, look, as much as I wish we were in a fully meritocratic society, people judge books by their cover. They say don't judge books by their cover. They do judge books by their cover. Appearance matters, first impressions matter. Same way, we have these halos. These things can help. whether you're meeting investors or trying to hire employees, those things help. So I'm not going to act like those things didn't help and say, oh, like it, I didn't need it whatsoever. But the thing I've just realized is that the only way to learn is to actually do the thing. You can't read a book about reaching out to 100 founders. You have to go do the thing and talk to them and ask, will you pay? And 90 of them say no, but five say yes. And you realize they said yes because they fit this exact profile. And then boom, you double down and do your next 100 outreaches to that segment. Dropbox didn't teach me that. So that's the nuance around would I have done Dropbox again? In hindsight, yes, because it got me to where I am today. But I really do think in high school, I could have tried to start this or even college. There was really nothing stopping me but my mind at that point, thinking I needed more experience to actually start it.
Right. You said you went to YC, so was it before or after you got the idea? Like did you just apply to YC with like an MVP or like a beginning of traction, or you just applied with the idea and you got everything starting there?
No, got into YC, got in with a different idea, which didn't work. So that idea was a video messaging app. In Paris, is it it's 6 hours ahead of New York? Is that correct? 7 hours or 5 hours?
Yeah.
6 hours, 6 hours.
6 hours. Okay. So the
Right now
idea
it's
was,
five. It's 5 right now because like there's like the change of time zone with
oh,
like.
gotcha. Okay. So 5 hour time zone difference. Let's say my end of day, we wanted to do a call. It's late for you guys. The idea was, what if we took Instagram stories and brought it to work, where you could post a story instead of a live call? Like people get the consumer habit, bring it to work, asynchronous communication, it's more efficient. Sounds cool. Like you guys, your heads are nodding, like, yeah, wait a second, that makes sense. But Paul Graham calls those ideas sitcom ideas, where, wait a second, everyone has a pet, everyone uses Facebook, let's make Facebook for pets. Oh yeah, you know what? That sounds interesting, but no one wants it. You don't need it. So what we learned is that one shocker, people do not like recording themselves on video. You two are in the 1% of the 1% who like actually like to get on a camera and record a video or do a podcast. Most people do not like that. Second thing is that people preferred real-time communication, especially during COVID. So this is another learning I've had too. YC or any investor doesn't determine if your business succeeds. If that was the case, every company YC invests in would be a unicorn decacorn. That doesn't mean YC doesn't have value. If someone asked me candidly, I say I'd recommend YC, especially as a first-time founder. But they don't determine if you succeed. We saw that point blank with the first thing. So Dula was actually a pivot. It came out of that failed company in YC. And the learning came from, hey, we spent a lot of money getting a company set up. And we thought this idea of initializing a company could be cool. And we realized there was a pain point there. We saw some other people doing something tangentially similar, but not as well or as bundled as we thought could happen too. But that's the other learning is that if only it was easy as raise money and your business works, there'd be a lot more successful businesses out there. But that's the harsh truth of entrepreneurship. You can't game it. That's another thing which I think you unlearn from college. Where in college, you can kind of reverse engineer what the professor's going to ask on the test, or here's the syllabus, or here's what I need to study. You can cram for the test. You can't cram for the product market fit. It's a grind. You have to continuously, repeatedly talk to customers. And then ultimately, the market doesn't lie. Our customers paying you and then continuing to pay you. You can't game that whatsoever.
How long did you wait until you said, okay, this idea is bullshit. I'm just gonna pivot and find something, another problem. So, and you're out to do like, how long did it take? Like, because it's hard for founders to pivot. I know it because I pivoted, but it took me like a year to pivot into an idea that initially you've heard about maybe about Mecore AI,
Sounds familiar.
the AI agent for recruitment.
Oh, yeah, I have. Yep.
It's the exact same idea I had like 2 years ago. We were building it, had an early traction, and we just like exhausted ourselves on the product and on the idea and like the market. We were in France, a different story, but also started at the same time. Our idea, because it could have been 100 million ARR today, as of today, as of Mecore. But it's really hard, like when you're a founder and like you really believe in your idea in the beginning. Like, how do you just let go and just say, okay, hey, I need to pivot or I need to focus on this? Like, that's. Like it's really hard. I mean, there's like opportunities every at every corner. Like every idea could be a billion-dollar idea. So how do you just like focus and or even say like, okay, this idea I tried, I made it. It starts to work. I'm making like 10K MRR, but you just say, okay, I gotta stop it. I'm gonna do something else or focus on this problem. How what does it take to do it?
This is where I think Y Combinator is really helpful because in YC, the hypothesis is you're building something that people need or want, right? That's the whole hypothesis for a startup. You're building something people need or want, which the rest of the world hasn't discovered yet. If that's the case, there should be people out there who have such a pain that they're willing to pay you for a really crappy version of it because it does, like you're building something for a select group that no one wants. So what I like about YC is every week you had these office hours and you have your primary metric. And you go into office hours, what's your metric? Okay. And then you say, what am I going to do to try to get to the metric? You talk about it. Then you have to come back and face the group next week and say what happened. Did you hit your metric? If not, why? If yes, why? If you do that 5 weeks in a row, you can't point the finger anywhere. Like, because you're trying different things, and that's what happened is week after week, the metric wasn't moving. And we were trying things we thought would work. You have to look in the mirror. We weren't doing fake things just to delude ourselves. No, we were actually doing things that started to work. The nail in the coffin was every customer asked for this Slack integration. And we said, fine, if we build it, will you use the app? They said, yeah. We built it. They didn't use the app. That was the nail in the coffin. And I've learned that term is the product death loop spiral, where you think you're one feature away or one product away, and customers are asking for it, but it never comes. In this case, got lucky because we built the feature we thought everyone wanted, and they still didn't use it. So that was actually easy. If anything, at that moment, I was like, damn it, I wish we got to this point earlier. That was my thing, is I wanted to know earlier that this thing wasn't going to break through or succeed there. So I think timing, as you're bringing out, is an interesting thing. The idea for Uber existed way before Uber, but the mobile phone unlocked Uber. So I think the timing, there's been many ideas. Actually, I think ideas just repeat themselves over time. Sometimes the platform has to exist, or it's the right team, or the market needs to be ready for it, whatever you want to call it. But that's how, and then to bring it to Duolit today, I actually think most companies don't die when they run out of money. They die when the founder or the team loses motivation, which is before the money actually runs out. So I think ultimately, even if the numbers are flat or the revenue is growing, if you believe there's a path towards breaking out of that, it's up to you. Like, it could take 10 years, or it could take 10 months or 10 weeks. But if you stick with it, then I think eventually the hardest balance is this balance move of conviction versus delusion. Because by nature, you have to be delusional to start something, because that's the definition of delusion, is believing in something which no one else believes in. And then the delusion meter comes down as more people start to use it. But I think everyone who inherently works at a startup or tries to start something is a bit delusional or crazy, but everything is delusional until it becomes reality in life.
How do you keep the motivation and like keep the belief, even if you take like hundreds of purchases and you see all those companies making like 10x growth in like, I don't know how, 2 weeks?
There are always going to be shiny objects. The grass is, there's this mindset of like the grass is, there's always going to be grass you think is greener, but I actually think that oftentimes you're sitting on a diamond field, or you're sitting on something, you don't realize it, or you miss it. So look, like there's always going to be companies that grow faster or raised $1 million in 1 second off one tweet. I think those are exceptions versus the norm. They do happen, of course, but my overall thought is ultimately, if you believe, and the belief comes from just hearing from customers. Like that's the single thing that we hear from customers and see, hey, they like what we're building, or they say this thing's missing, that's why I chose you. Okay, like that never gets old, having a customer message you saying, this is incredible what you're building. My business couldn't have been existed without you. Or like, holy crap. I was at a conference a few weeks ago. I was talking to this guy, e-commerce. The next morning he came up to me and said, dude, I woke up thinking about you. Like, yeah, I was about to go file my taxes on my own. I was like, holy sh, like this guy went to sleep, woke up thinking of me because of the problem you're saving. So like, that to me is the motivation of like the customer is paying you. And look, it's fun. A lot of people sometimes say, like, I think a mission does matter. Like, there's this missionary versus mercenary. Am I here just to build a business, or do I care in the mission? I think technically you can do it the mercenary approach. So like, I'm just going to go build this thing. But if you have a big enough why, that really does power you through the days when you're not maybe getting the feedback, or you're facing a big fire. So for me personally, I really try to share every single week customer stories with the team, customer highlights, because the momentum is really important. And we're getting this feedback. And the feedback loops, I think, is the hardest thing, because it could take 3 months to build out a new product. And then before you get the feedback, it's 9 months later before you're getting the usage. So how do you get the micro feedback along the way? But ultimately, it comes down to, for me personally, we haven't shared this publicly, but we just passed an eight-figure run rate. So 10 million plus run rate. The growth is also exciting too. Like, as you see things start to work more, you're like, holy crap. So many mistakes made the last 4 years. Imagine if we just slice half of those in half. We're bound to actually go faster. If anything, I was the biggest bottleneck in so many things. So that gets exciting too, because I can see the path for growth, and you can see things starting to work. And again, maybe for some companies it takes 4 months to go from 1 to 100 million in ARR. For others, it takes 40 years, right? Like, every journey is going to be different. But ultimately, I just do think that if you can see the micro signs, ultimately from customers, that's the most addicting thing, is you're literally building something. And I think one of y'all just said this earlier. the best entrepreneurs, they just want to be useful, right? Like they want to build something that has an impact. Like, don't get me wrong. I ask people what motivates you. Is it money, power, pleasure, or fame? All of those things matter. But I think a lot of entrepreneurs, it's more than that. It's like, I want to build something that other people find value in and help other people. Or maybe, and then it ties to one of those reasons. So that to me is the most addicting thing. I think that's the best way to keep motivation is see and get feedback from customers and just keep doing that over and over again.
And how do you separate the good feedback versus the bad feedback? Like, well, which feedback do you end up trusting?
The user owns the problem, but we own the solution. And my favorite example of this is when Henry Ford was building the car, the Model T. If he asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse and buggy, like make the wheels bigger, or like let's get horses and train them to run faster. But as the inventor, you own the solution. Like otherwise, the user would just know how to verbalize it and go build it themselves potentially. So all feedback, that's how I run it through, is okay, what is the actual problem that they're saying? And then it's our job. That's, I think, the cool thing, to actually come up with a solution. You can get feedback from customers then. So yeah, that's how I would say what's the good versus bad feedback. All feedback could be good or bad, but it's our job to terse through it or to parse through it and then put something out there for customers.
All right. And if you were like an international founder, let's say a French founder or UK founder or Chinese or whatever, what would be the key steps that they should take to start a US-based company with Doula?
Let's break some false truths. The very first one is you can start a business from outside the US. So let's establish that first, because a lot of people are like, no, you can't do that. You have to be a US citizen. You can start from outside the US, from France or the UK or China. Number two, the best type of entity to form, and I'll give you the one answer, because lawyers tell you 11 things you shouldn't do. I'll tell you the one thing you should do. If you are raising US venture capital, form a Delaware C Corp. It's required by US investors. You can then have different class structures for your shares. There's the Chancery Court in Delaware, so there's a good case law history there, which lawyers like and investors like. So Delaware C Corp is the way to go. Y Combinator will require it, et cetera. If you're not raising venture capital, form an LLC. You get liability protection. You get the benefits of being able to get an EIN for a business bank account as well. You have more professionalism versus being a freelancer. If you live outside the US, you also can choose any state to form it in the US. Wyoming's actually my recommendation versus Delaware, because the LLC was invented in Wyoming. It's cheaper than Delaware, $62 per year versus $300. Don't sleep on Wyoming. People call it the Swiss Alps of the Rockies. It's legit. They're very forward-friendly too. Very friendly for e-commerce businesses and other businesses too. But you can choose Delaware or another state if you'd like. So the final step is cool. Now you know, non-US resident, my recommendation is an LLC in Wyoming or a Delaware C Corp. You then need to get your company formed in the state, get an EIN, apply for a bank account. And that's the first part of the process. The final thing I'll say for a founder in France is you can't forget about the rest of the journey, which is bookkeeping and taxes. So those things are required. Bookkeeping is quite literally preparing your statements for taxes. And what are statements? They're made of numbers. You're tracking your numbers, which give you visibility into the business. You can only manage what you can measure. And then come tax season, which let me remind everyone, there's two certainties in life, death and taxes. I can't help you with death. Go follow Brian Johnson for that. I can help you with taxes. So you have to file your taxes. That's our goal as a business. Go file them. So don't forget about that. You're just getting started. Our entire business is predicated on, hey, for everything else, your time's too valuable. Let us handle the bookkeeping and tax too. You don't have to buy those up front. You don't even have to do them up front, but have a plan for them. So whether you're a French founder or a founder in the UK or in India, similar processes apply. The final thing I'll say is always talk to a tax professional in your local country. So our CPAs, for example, we do know some of the international tax treaties, but you'll always want to talk to a CPA locally to understand your business is set up there properly, whether you're in Dubai or the UAE or in Paris. But you can start a business from anywhere in the world in the US, and I think that's incredibly exciting.
No, very exciting. I mean, a lot of French founders nowadays want to expand their business or even start their business in the US, and I'm sure they will find this very helpful. But what would you say, when is the right time, for example, to incorporate in the US for founders based abroad? Because
Yeah,
some
like,
of them might not have like a lot of revenue already. So when would you recommend them to settle an entity, for example, in the US to start doing business there?
yeah, like for me, for example, like I'm a founder of a service company doing AI based in France. I would love to get US clients, but do you think it's a stop or a no-go for like US-based customers to say, I don't want to pay this guy new because he's in France, or do you think it's a must to have your incorporation based in the US or not? I mean, it's a two-sided question from me and Matteo, but
I'll answer them both. The best time to start a business in the US is when you need to get paid or you're about to get paid. So let's take two examples. If you're raising venture, the investor is going to have to give you the check, right? So to give the check, they need a business bank account. They're not sending it to your personal account. They're definitely not doing that. So it has to go to a business bank account and you need a Delaware C Corp. So to get the bank account, you need the EIN. To get the EIN, you need a C Corp. If you're raising venture, the timeline is cool. When you have certainty or you know for sure the check's going to come in, you're going to need to start that process. Before then, depends on how much capital you have saved or how long you're going to be building, but you could technically start before. It gives you more credibility. But if I were to say the actual time you need it is to get the check. Now, for an LLC, the time I would say to form is again when you need to get paid. Now, there are cases where, look, let's just face say it, US customers are probably going to be more comfortable paying a US payment processor versus sending a wire to an international bank account, to an Indian bank account, or to a French bank account. That being said, if the pain point is strong enough, someone's going to pay whatever currency. They'll probably pay, like they'll pay crypto, they'll do whatever if the pain point's big enough. So what I would say, let's use this example of French founder or French team. Do I need it to get US customers? At some point, I think eventually you will. But what I would do is, okay, let me talk to a US customer. Let me even sign the con get the contract sent to them for the terms. And then we can say, hey, there's like a net 30 payment. So like you're gonna have to pay me in 30 days. And then boom, you can start to get the company set up. But it comes down to your level of confidence that you will be getting paid customers from the US. Let me give an example. Let's say you're a Shopify consultant in Europe and you have hundreds of customers. And you actually know the second we start running ads in the US, the model's proved out. I would form that entity yesterday. And yesterday, because it takes 3 to 4 weeks to get the EIN. So ultimately, you have to work backwards to get the payment processor. The bank account comes before. To get the bank account, that takes about a week. Before then, you need the EIN, which can take 3 to 4 weeks. So to start the LLC, if you need a bank account today, you should have started a month ago. So I would work back in either scenario for when you should actually start the company.
But okay, so it's very, very detailed explanation. But apart from that, are there any other concepts founders need to master when launching a business in the US? What's your take on that?
I think that's a good question in terms of what concepts do founders need to master? You don't need to master everything. I think that's something I thought I had to be an expert in everything, but the point of our business is you should understand what we're doing. But the whole point is, no, you don't need to be a master in bookkeeping or taxes or sales tax. That's our job. You should be a master in your zone of genius, which could be product, could be partnerships, it could be design. But that is the thing you should focus on and then hire out or outsource everything else in the company. So that would be my answer is you should understand, hey, I should talk to a tax professional in my country so I understand what the requirements are. And I should talk to someone in the US, Dula or someone else, so I understand what's required. But you do not need to master it or become an expert unless you want to. If your zone of genius is the compliance, then you should focus on the compliance and then build a team around you for the other things.
So knowing enough just to briefly understand what's going on, but outsourcing the actual work to professionals.
Right. And when you start, you're going to have to do everything, right? So you're going to have to understand a bit of everything. But then as the business grows, you can cover your weak spots with, hey, like an accountant here, or someone for social content here, or someone for design here, and all these other areas of the business.
When you launched Dula, what were your assumptions?
I think the biggest assumption we learned quickly, but we validated, was people want a bundled solution, that they the business in a box or the one-stop shop, they want things all in one place. And we learned that from just offering, hey, if we combined all these things for this price, would people pay? And they did pay. So that was the best way. And I think this is the scariest thing is asking someone, here it is, will you go pay? And if they really want it, they'll actually pay. Otherwise, they won't. And then the way we learned that was just talking to people. So that's what I would say is like, even in the future, if I want to validate something, I'll go ask someone, like, will you sign up for the partnership program? Or we have this new offering. Would you like to get on a call and give feedback? And all those things are early indicators of, okay, you're onto something because they're willing to invest and spend the time on that thing.
Got it, got it. Dula operates in a very highly regulated space. How did you build trust early on with your first customers, and what are the key things to bear in mind when operating in such a space? For example, for founders that want to like a build that want to build a company in such a space, what do they need to know before taking the leap?
When you're starting a startup or any company, you have an advantage which no other company has or bigger companies don't have is they're talking to you, the founder. And people like that. They're like, well, I actually get to talk to you. And you're the one who dictates or controls what's built next as well. So lean into that. Like you can say, hey, this bigger company, are they going to have you on speed dial? You can WhatsApp me personally. You can send me an iMessage or email. Matter of fact, tell me the five things you want and I'll tell you when we're going to go build them. You have that advantage. So that is your hidden advantage. And the way you build trust is they're talking to you. And then you win over that first person who really has the pain point. Then you turn that person into a case study. You record a video with them, you have a blog post, boom. Now for the next customer, hey, have you worked with anyone? Yes, we have. Check this out. Oh, okay, you know what? That looks neat. And then they like you too. Next thing you know, you have three case studies. Then you start to get Trustpilot reviews. There's feedback. So it's a slow cycle, but you have to bootstrap it when you're starting. And I think that's how you can build the trust, whether it's regulated or not. And then for working in a regulated industry, I think there's always going to be certain regulations. The key is, again, you don't have to be, I would say you don't have to be a master. You need to really understand them, though. Like, I'm not an expert in the history of Delaware case law, but I understand the filing requirements due in Delaware each year. So, like, you need to have an understanding of them so you can build your business around it, but you don't have to be the world's PhD level best expert in a certain topic.
So for example, when there are new like policy changes, you are not the one like adjusting your product and making the changes. Like you hired someone to take care of this and to keep track of what's new, right?
Depends. If there's a new tax change or a tax filing requirement, our team is very aware of it. The entire team can say, hey, we noticed this thing. Do we have to make a change? I try to stay aware as well. So usually the team just wants to stay aware, but now we have a full group of people who are keeping their eyes out for it as well.
Got it, got it.
What are the biggest mistakes you've done over the last 4.5 years and the key learnings that you can just share with us? To scaling faster and like get to $1 million of AR as soon as possible.
Single biggest mistake. This is an unteachable truth because everyone says it, but everyone makes the same mistake. I'll give you one example, then I'll tell you the mistake that we made, which again is an unteachable truth. Y Combinator, everyone, they all say, do not hire fast and fire slow because you're going to do it. They're going to say you're burning. You're going to take, the first person, you're going to think they can do it. And then when you realize it's not a good fit, you're going to be way too slow because you've never let someone go before or never had a hard conversation. But everyone does it. So in reality, what you want to do is hire very slowly, take the time to meet someone. And then if it's not a fit, it's best for everyone to move on quickly. That's one mistake we made too. But the biggest mistake, there's this saying, the riches are in the niches. And you can either serve many people mediocrely or a select group spectacularly. The mistake we made is we did not focus fast enough. And don't get me wrong, we've grown, but we would have been able to grow or scale faster if instead of saying anywhere from anywhere in the world can start a business with us, let's pick one geography and own or dominate that geography. Influencer partnerships, content partnerships, better branding on the website, webinars with experts in that region. You can go so much deeper. So Doula today, again, our business in a box works for many different countries, many different regions, but we're a business in a box for e-commerce because we've noticed it really resonates for this group. And a Shopify or Amazon seller doing 10 to 100K in revenue, we have an incredible business in a box solution for e-commerce there. That being said, you can drop the e-commerce and the indie hacker in Dubai can still use us. But candidly, it's going to be a really good solution for them, but it's even better for the e-commerce entrepreneur who needs the e-commerce analytics. The venture-backed startup founder from France can use Doula too and will be a really good solution. But that is where, in hindsight, if we had focused faster, you'd scale faster and counterintuitively. If you want to boil the ocean, the fastest way is to boil it one spoon at a time versus trying to like boil everything at once because then nothing boils. Same thing here. Picking one niche, really attacking it, building traction there gives you more capital, gives you more trust to go and do it faster in another area. So riches are in the niches. That's the single biggest thing, which even I think of now, are we niched down enough? 10 to 100K, that range is too wide. Why not make it 20 to 40? There's always ways you can niche down more and we'll continue to do quarter after quarter.
I mean, the go-to-market is, I think, the hardest thing for any first-time founder, or because like it's so hard to just focus on that problem. Yeah, as I said, like there's opportunity at every corner, so it's very hard to focus. And like, how do you pick the one? How do you pick the niche? How do you pick it? That's my question.
You either have the insight, you see, because you are the user, so you know the pain point. So you're solving for yourself, knowing that it's a pain for me. Can I find someone else? Or you can strategically, and now I've learned we did this. Now I know it's a strategy. You can go broad to go niche. You can tactically say, hey, to start, we're going to let anyone come in. We're going to do entity formation for anyone or AI services for anyone. But then once people come in, we'll pick and choose. This is the type of customer we want. They paid right away without questions. They don't ask many questions, and they have an actual use case which we're good at solving. Versus like the other person who's like not a good use case. They didn't have as much budget. So you can go broad to go niche, and I think that's actually an approach that can work. But you need to be disciplined about. I'm going broad to go niche, and by this date, we're going to make a decision. Or after this number of data sets or this interviews, otherwise you're just floating and you're deluding yourself into, oh no, we're just trying to serve everyone. Versus serving no one if you aren't special enough. So I'd say starts with your insights, but then you can go broad to go niche as well.
Okay, and just to go back on the recruitment, thank you very much for the insight. It's very insightful. Just to go back on the hiring part, like what's the first hire any company should make? Like, 'cause as founders, we work all the time with we always think that we can just like we don't need to hire. We just we working until 2 a.m. It's fine. I mean, it's part of our job. But how do you learn to delegate and what to delegate? Like, that's kind of like. The trick to most founders, because I'm in that position right now, we're still two founders starting to delegating a bit with freelancers, but it's still very hard like to let go a real task to someone and just okay, say I'm taking a risk, I'm just hiring that guy. He's gonna cost me 100K a year, but it's fine, I'm gonna hire
One of
those
the
kind of
first
tasks.
hires I actually wish that I made was is a really strong executive assistant or virtual assistant. And the reason why is because there really are in your days $10 tasks, $100 tasks, $1,000 tasks, and $10,000 tasks. $10,000 tasks are picking your ICP. Who's your ideal customer profile? What features should we build? You need to spend as much time there. A $10 task could be archiving spam emails from your inbox. Like that's probably less than $10. That's a 10 cent task. But you even spending 5 minutes on that, such a bad use of your time. So those are two stream examples there. But I actually wish that I gave myself more leverage by having a really strong executive assistant from day one, because you can then start to move up the stack. So, whether it's basic things like inbox management or coordinating a conference that you're going to, types of things where you can give the direction, but there are things that you uniquely can't do. They're not your zone of genius. The sooner I could move out of those, the more time I can spend thinking about, okay, let me spend 2 hours going through all the customer feedback we've gotten and actually think what we should build next. No one can do that because they don't have all the connections or the dots or the visibilities that you have. So
Yeah.
that's actually what I would have done and wish I did a long time back, because that'll give me more leverage to actually think about, okay, I'm trying to hire a freelancer for design. I now have more time to interview more candidates because I don't feel as rushed doing six other things on my plate. And then ultimately, when it comes to hiring that right person, I think this is where, again, the mistake we made was hire fast, fire slow versus being way more thoughtful. My favorite book on recruiting, it's called Who. The book's just called Who. It's by Jeff Smart. Incredible book, but it just walks through the full recruiting process. It walks through the types of questions you should ask, the interview process you should run through as well. And ultimately, it summarizes that any issue you have in your business, it isn't a what issue, it's always a who issue. You're missing the right person in the right seat to do it. So really recommend that book. That completely opened up my eyes on hiring and how important people are for the business, which again, sounds silly or naive, but I just really like the frameworks they outline there.
Okay, thanks for the tip. I'll try to look it up. What was the most effective growth lever that helped you break through in the early days and scale like from 0 to 100K in MRR?
There's been three main channels for us, which now the key is how do we pour more fuel on the fire for each? The first was paid. So through Google Ads, it's very intent-based, right? Someone's going to Google and searching in how to start an LLC from France. Someone comes, they come to your website, they chat with you, and you can close them there. So that worked. And we still do that today, but I want to move off of it because there's no compounding value. The second is word of mouth. So once you do get founders and you have a good experience, founders know founders. They'll tell each other. So that actually absolutely works once you get customers coming in. And then the third is partnerships. So if you have a partner, let's say they are a Amazon coach who lives in France and they're teaching people how to start a business that's global, those people will need an LLC and a bank account. So rather than you going out and finding the individual founders, the coach is going to say, hey, go to doula. And the coach gets a bit of a commission. So those are the channels which, even when starting, we started to see traction. And now we're trying to be way more focused in each of them. Again, more on the content side instead of paid now. And then also just really strong focus on partnerships as well. But I do think, like many things in life, I heard this saying recently, you can practice 1,000 kicks one time, like if you're a martial artist, or you can practice one kick 1,000 times. And I think when it comes to growth channels, all you need is one. You're one channel away from hitting the next stage. Once you hit that stage, then you can add a second channel. But that's where, again, go broad to go niche. You just need one channel, and there's way more juice than you think in the channel. So even now, I really try to think about, okay, what's the one channel? Not five channels. What's the one channel which we think can work? And let's attack that channel.
I think that's what Alex Hormozy keeps saying. Like, you need to double down on the channel. Like, if you get to 1 million, why not? Like, you don't have to open a new market or new country.
Yep.
Just go to 10 million, go to 100. When you're 100, then you can open. Yeah, that's kind of like, need to stay focused. But like, I see that you still have like a couple of channels. Did you find your channel or not yet?
Yeah, for us, the channel is partnerships. That's like the channel we're going hard on, and then content. So I mean, technically you can say that's two channels, but we have two teams now that can focus, right? We have a marketing team that's laser focused on the content side. And then we have a partnerships team that's laser focused on partnerships. Those channels alone, I see 10x growth potential on both. Way more than 10x, but step at a time. So I see, let's get to that first stage, then you continue to do more after it.
Do you think if you had only one team of, like, instead of having two teams of five people, having one team of 10 people doing only content or only partnerships, that would help you scale faster? Or
in this case, that's a really good point. In this case, I'm not entirely sure, because we know with our business, and this came from talking to users, it's multi-touch. So we know when a user comes in, the partner has some trust. They hit your website. They then go look at your socials, right? They look at your YouTube videos. They see, they follow you maybe. And that is part of the multi-touch attribution or conversion. So I actually think that sometimes if you pull the plug on one thing entirely, it actually hurts another part of the funnel. So we've seen that too. Like, I break it into top of funnel and then middle and bottom of funnel. I think a lot of our content is, once someone comes in and knows about us, they then start to see us every day from social. And then when they're like, I want to learn this thing, they'll go to our YouTube and they'll binge five YouTube videos. They're like, yeah, this company's cool. I want to work with them. That being said, I think you bring up a good point in that if you see a channel where you're putting in a dollar and getting three back, and you're seeing another channel where you're putting in a dollar and getting one back, most people, and we did this, would just keep doing that. But what you should actually do is stop putting one in where you're getting one and allocate everything towards the channel you're putting in one and getting three out. So I think, the key is, again, just understanding your user, how they purchase and what parts of the process led them to convert. And then you don't want to break that, but then it's about, cool, how do we make more come in at the top and improve the quality of what's happening in the middle so that you overall see more growth coming from the entire funnel?
Very clear. Thank you, Arjun. So just for our listeners who, for example, don't have the budget to hire like a marketing team or partnership team, do you have any advice for them on getting started, mastering like a channel and really like not being afraid to take the leap of faith and like post, for example, post on LinkedIn, even if it doesn't get any likes? What are the right mindset to adopt to overcome those fears?
Well, yeah, when you're starting, it can feel so overwhelming. There's so many different things and channels, and there's no teams. There's just one person or maybe two people. But let's just say it's one. Here's what I would say. The mindset I wish I took earlier, because I wish now I started posting way more consistently from day zero, is most people don't care about you. Like, it sounds a bit harsh, but it's the spotlight effect. We all think people care about us more than they actually do. So here's what I would wish I had done. Pick one platform to start, whatever you're comfortable with. I think Twitter or LinkedIn's easy because it's text-based. You don't have to get in front of a camera and edit. And just post consistently. It doesn't have to be every day, although I'd recommend just like do it every day so you build the machine or the habit. But it could be one time per week, three times per week. Just do it consistently. And the other thing I wish I knew is that you don't have to become an influencer. Just be a documenter. Document your journey. Share what you're learning. No one else is going through what you're learning. Oh, today I realized why we should have pivoted earlier. Or, oh, today I tried this on a call and it worked. Just document that journey. Selfishly, you'll have a time capsule you can look back at. And it also will. People like to see stories as you go. Then I think the third thing is, you're right, you're not going to have teams before you start. So what you have to just think through is, okay, what is the highest leverage thing I can do right now? Do I think a partnership is going to get us our next 10 customers? Or do I think that recording a really high quality YouTube video and actually paying a freelance editor to publish that video is going to get us those 10 customers. You have to really make that tradition, that trade-off from what do I think is the highest priority or use of my time? And it, maybe you want to try both of them. So over the course of 4 weeks, here are four bets we want to make. Let's try each of them. Oh crap, the partnership drove 20 customers. Now we're going to go build a partnerships team because we saw that actually happen there. So starting early, you have to ignore what other people think. And yeah, I really wish we started earlier. We've started now investing way more on YouTube. I wish that when we started, I had someone just next to me recording me where I talk each day. And even, I just wish because, like, damn, it would have been so cool to go back in time and actually hear myself talk through the things I was stressing about now, which now I'm like, wow, those are silly, stupid things that you were actually stressing about then. So I think there's like personal reasons too, but ultimately, the biggest reason I think is you don't want to ever look back and say, I wish, if only, like, I wish I tried this or if only that, and have that regret. Combine that with, hey, the fact that people don't really care about what you're doing as much as you think they do, and it's more in our head. That's made it way more freeing for me to say, I'm going to post every day, and I don't care if my friends make fun of me in the group chat. I'm just going to do it every day because I've seen enough results from it happening. And I do know that the person who does that for 5 years, you're going to look back and say, that was the reason why the thing worked. So yeah, it's made me more comfortable doing it. And if anything, I don't think you're marketing hard enough unless you are getting roasted in the group chat. It's a really good sign if your friends are making fun of you. That's a good proxy that you're on the
We are definitely roasted on the group chat, so
right path. There you go.
but I mean no I mean also you like about like being recorded every day, I think it came with the creation of TikTok and like always documenting what's going on in your life, so like it's all about timing at the end of the day, I think, because how could you have like how could you have known that it was the thing to do in like 5, 6 years, 10 years
So
from now.
true. There'll be new channels, new platforms, maybe video's hot today, but then blogs are hot. So, which is why just like pick something you feel comfortable doing. It could be as simple as end of each night. Now there's voice to text. Like I wish even just years ago, I had a voice to text note on my phone and then you could screenshot it and tweet it. Like imagine if you just did that every single year, then after a year, you have a really cool series. Actually, I might start doing that. I don't know anyone who's doing that, like a voice to text voice note series. But point is like, just pick something you're comfortable with. And then even if it doesn't get likes, you have selfishly your own memento that you can look back to.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to keep being consistent. And what's the hidden truth no one talks about for reaching $1 million in AR?
Well, let me caveat this. I've only done it once, right? The previous companies didn't work, so I haven't done this multiple times, so it's a bit hard to give general advice for others. So that's what I'll caveat with. But I think that if you can get one person to pay you, and you can then get to two, you can get like it's stacking it like that. Like, can I get to one? Can I get to two? Can I get to five? Can I get to 10? And breaking down, because a million can sound really overwhelming, right? But let's break it down. A million is, let's say you have a $2,000 product, that's 500 customers, right? So 500 customers paying you $2,000 gets you to a million. So, okay, 500 customers, that sounds like a lot as well. Like, I don't know, 500 people, that's huge. But then let's break it down even more. Like, that's actually a little, that's less than two people per day paying you $2,000. Okay, but then 2,000 up front, that's a lot of money. What if we have 1 year contracts? So 2,000 divided by 12, they're now paying you like a little less than 200 per month. All I'm asking you is 100 something bucks a day for two people. Okay, now you actually have an offering. It could be an agency, right? I'm going to manage your Shopify website for you for 100 something bucks a month, done for you. And right now it's just me, but you can hire maybe freelancers or agency people to help you. Okay, if I need to close two people per day, I maybe I go crazy to start and I say for 12 hours, I'm going to do calls every hour. Like th every 30 minutes, that's 24 calls. I need to close one out of 12 people, less than 10%. Okay, like all of a sudden, you took this massive goal and you broke it down into something that is way more palatable. So I think ultimately, again, I can't give advice for others because I haven't done the thing. And other that's where, side note, I think that's where imposter syndrome comes from, where you're like, oh, I feel imposter syndrome. I don't really feel it anymore because I only talk about things which I've done, right? So even in this case, I'm not going to tell you how to get to nine figures. I can say eight figures because we've just done that. And I'll talk about that, right? The eight figure run rate, 1 million I can talk about, but I'm not going to talk about other things I haven't done. It's kind of like I'm not going to ask someone who hasn't run a marathon how to run a marathon. I know, I'll go talk to the person who's run a marathon. Nothing against that person. It's not personal, but I want to ask the person who's really done it before. And I'm not saying you can't learn from the person who hasn't run a marathon, but for the specific thing you're trying to learn, like you can find someone who's actually done the thing. So my answer there is break it down and then pick that day or what the week looks like, pick the metric. And then you have to validate that someone's willing to pay you with their time or money. If you can do it for the week, boom. Now you know it's a repeatable process that you can continue to do.
What's next for Doula, and where do you see the company in 5 years? And also, like, how do you see the impact of, for example, AI tools on such business?
We'll do this backwards. AI won't take your job, but someone using AI will take your job. The point there is that it's here, it's going to come. And if I'm more efficient with AI, I'm going to beat you head to head because I'm just more efficient. That could be from internal automations, that could be from software. It could be automating away people's jobs, but I actually believe that AI is going to make our team more effective. Our bookkeepers, the analogy I use is today they can serve 50 people. But once we put the suit on them, Tony Stark's Tony Stark, but you put the suit on him, he becomes Iron Man. I want to turn our bookkeepers into Tony Stark or turn them into Iron Man by building the suit. AI is going to do that. That's my vision. The next thing is that in 5 years, our goal is when someone's starting an e-commerce business or scaling it, Shopify is the front end, or you go to Amazon. The back end, you just go to doula. You doula it. We become a verb. The same way I'm going to go Uber there, or let's get an Airbnb or Airbnb it. You doula it. You just become part of the vernacular. So that's 5 years. If we achieve what we can achieve with focus, we can get there too. And then the last thing I would say is our goal and our mission is if we can reach 1 billion people, which I think you can do through content, we can increase entrepreneurship globally, which I think is really freaking cool. Just in life, being able to say, hey, we were able to help or impact one, let alone 10, let alone hundreds, let alone thousands of people. So in 5 years, I'd love to look back and say, yeah, we actually reached a ton of people and had an impact. Because my greatest fear is I don't want to float through life. I want to feel like I actually did something of value. Our time on life is so short already. Someone recently said it's 4,000 weeks, which is pretty wild. But like if you live to your
Wow.
70 something, 4,000 weeks, which is insane. But it just puts into perspective of like, okay, I want to do something special in those 4,000 weeks when I'm here. That being said, I think we'll live for 8,000 weeks because there'll be medical advances. But point being said is that I just don't want to float through life and helping people, it never gets old. And I think that's what we get to do with Doula.
Brian Johnson will help us get to 8,000
Exactly.
weeks. Where
Amazing.
can people find learn more about Doula and follow your journey?
Doula.com for any founder starting or scaling. You can schedule a consultation and get a demo. We're happy to chat with you for free. You can get a demo of everything we offer. We'd love to work with you, whether it's now or in the future. Me personally, Arjun Mahadevan on social. Again, my goal is I want to be omni-channel, posting every day, just documenting, sharing the journey. Again, I don't care if it's cringe because I've gotten over that too. Cringe is a prerequisite for success, and people just don't really care about you as much as you think they do. So follow along on social. I try to be very authentic and just share what's actually happening behind the scenes. And I really appreciate you guys having me on.
Thank you so much, Arjun. It was so fun having you. I hope it was the same for you. See you next time, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank
Thank
you,
you,
guys.
Adrian.
Appreciate it.